When we think back to great natural disasters like the 1989 Bay Area earthquake and Hurricane Katrina, it's usually the images and stories of destruction that stick in our minds. Rebecca Solnit believes that there's an alternative and even more important story connected to these disasters because they often give rise to new communities in which the best of human nature emerges and a remarkable spirit of generosity takes over. Rebecca Solnit is the author of 10 books, including River of Shadows, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. This latest, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster, is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it has brought her back to our show today. Hi.
Good afternoon.
You said that this project stemmed from an observation that people have a good time during disasters, or that they look back on these events nostalgically. Really?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say nostalgically, but it really, for me, began with the 1989 earthquake where I had, and here's where the language almost fails us. We don't have the language to describe what people have. You could call it a deep time, a time where people feel connected and urgent and purposeful, and the trivial things we waste our lives on fall away. But with that disaster in particular, when I ask people about it, so many people's faces light up with joy. But even people talking about aspects of Katrina or 9/11, certainly the Mexico City earthquake of 1985, people often found things to be joyful about that were missing from their ordinary lives.
Because you say that you didn't find people to have a delight in the destruction, but rather an appetite for belonging, involvement, power, and voice.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's funny because usually when we talk about disaster, we take the position that everything was just great before the disaster hit. But everyday life is something of a disaster for so many people that even a disaster sometimes provides a respite from or a chance to revolt against. And people find a chance to be somebody else, to connect in ways that are impossible or unimaginable in ordinary times. They find the meaningful work that they don't get from their ordinary lives.
It also makes outsiders more aware of those problems. For example, New Orleans, the areas that were hardest hit were really awful places to live in for many people. And yet nobody talked much about it until the places were destroyed.
Exactly. And New Orleans was an ongoing tragedy of poverty, disinvestment, urban decay, job loss, et cetera, before the hurricane hit. And, and the hurricane was about as bleak as any disaster I've looked at because it wasn't really a natural disaster that hit New Orleans. And, the hurricane was one thing. The levees breaking was a man-made disaster. And then the transformation of it into a social catastrophe in which people were not allowed to evacuate, in which they were demonized as barbarian hordes who needed to be controlled rather than treated like our brothers and sisters who need to be supported. You know, it went on and on, as disasters often do. There's no such thing as a truly natural disaster.
Well, what many people remember from Hurricane Katrina is the TV footage of the destruction of the city, the stranded people on the rooftops, but also images of people breaking into stores and carrying arms full of goods away from them. And that has a real impact on public perception of this sort of thing.
Well, the media was so much, people took some things that they definitely didn't need to take. They also took some things they absolutely needed, like food and water and diapers and medicine. So far as I can tell, the TV cameras and the breaking into store stuff happened to be very conveniently situated near each other. But the scale of that's never really been addressed. You know, did 100 people take stuff? Did 1,000 people? Did 10,000? And does it really matter when grandmothers are dying in overheated attics and babies' bodies are floating in the streets? You know, the obsession with private property and the control and protection of private property rather than human life was part of the madness, not of the people who were stranded in the disaster, but of the people making the major decisions and telling the rest of the world about it. The media and the government went mad in Katrina.
And you say that the images contributed to something called elite panic.
Yeah, elite panic is a term coined by Karen Chess and Lee Clark of Rutgers University. And they addressed the fact that disaster sociologists long ago realized that panic, you know, the sort of stampeding, screaming hordes of people doing very foolish things or unable to take care of themselves, is essentially a myth. But there is something they call elite panic, which is the people in power, the people in control, are terrified by the rest of us, believe that when they're not in control, things are out of control, believe that they need to reassert control, often very violently, which is what you saw in Katrina. The governor of Louisiana, said, we have troops with M16s and that are locked and loaded. They're fresh from Iraq and they're ready to go in there. That's not what you offer people in a disaster unless you think that, we revert to some state of Hobbesian monstrosity when things go astray.
There was also a bridge that was closed, and some people are still questioning the reasons for that. There were vigilantes patrolling the area to protect people's property. Is this sort of elite panic common? Did we see similar things in the other disasters that you write about in this book, the San Francisco earthquake, the Mexico City earthquake, or one that we definitely have to talk about, the Halifax explosion of 1917?
You see it in different degrees in different disasters. The San Francisco earthquake, which came in an era of a lot of popular unrest from working people, was very intense. The estimates are that up to 500 people were shot as looters or for not obeying orders. And the U.S. military, which was stationed at the northern edge of San Francisco in the 1906 earthquake, essentially staged a hostile takeover of the city, really bullied the citizens, prevented them from fighting fires, and were obsessed with regaining control over a city that wasn't necessarily out of control.
Anarchy is the big fear, isn't it? Always in situations like this?
Well, the notion is that when we revert to our primordial nature that's chaotic, savage, brutal, selfish, etc. And I think we revert in some sense, but not, and maybe even to a primordial nature, although that's a more philosophical discussion. But we revert to something, all the evidence shows, that is more altruistic, more improvisational, more empowered, more empathic, more resourceful. And people really rise to the occasion in these absolutely extraordinary ways. And it's that sense of, who you yourself become in a disaster that people are often so joyous about, as well as how they're able to connect to people, even though they're also grief-stricken by what happened or, in some other way traumatized.
My guest is Rebecca Solnit, Solnit. Her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disasters. It's published by Viking. People help again and again. They almost feel that it's necessary to do something. So they go out and they direct traffic, or they'll take a boat and rescue people.
Yeah, and the spontaneous convergence of people to help is one of the amazing things that happens in disaster. And the way people just pretty much know what needs to be done and do it. It doesn't mean that we're all experts and, can do what the doctor here before me could do, for example. But they can, it's probably the neighbors who are going to rescue you if your building falls down. The emergency personnel will be too few, too far away, etc. But people truly know. And one of those expressions of delight about the 1989 earthquake, who's 20th anniversary in San Francisco is almost upon us, came from a friend of mine driving home several miles from the baseball game, who found that after the blackout the earthquake produced, somebody was at every intersection directing traffic. And that's anarchy in the sense that people who call themselves anarchists speak of it, where there's no top-down authority controlling things, but people are essentially making a working system from the bottom up.
Now, do you find that there are different kinds of responses depending on the kind of disaster, a natural disaster like an earthquake or a terrorist attack like 9/11 or an accidental man-made disaster like Halifax?
As all of them are emergencies in which things urgently need to be done and ordinary life has been completely disrupted. And people respond very similarly. It doesn't really matter whether it's an earthquake or a terrorist who made the building collapse if your focus is on getting somebody out and helping them breathe.
And does it always happen? Can you think of an example when the vast majority of citizens didn't actively help each other promote spontaneous aid?
You can get into very complicated situations where people have been pitted against each other and long simmering animosities and fears and things like that have been embedded in the population. But nothing around disaster resembles that, and a lot of wartime as well, where people are dealing with their fellow citizens when London is being bombed or something. People are also that brave, altruistic, improvisational, resourceful community that really rises to the occasion.
New Yorkers will remember blackouts, for example, where suddenly citizens go out in the street and start directing traffic and helping in every way that they can. It does seem so incredibly spontaneous.
It is remarkable, and I feel like the most untold stories about Katrina and 9/11, the two major disasters in this country in this decade, is that the incredible scale of that outpouring of help, the fact that 300,000 to 500,000 people were evacuated by boat from Lower Manhattan by a spontaneously assembled flotilla of all kinds of craft, the scale of the volunteer effort and the disaster relief in Katrina by individuals and volunteers and groups, you know, is really profound.
Well, many people listening will remember the four of the five disasters that you write about here, beginning with the Mexico City earthquake in 1985. The 1906 San Francisco earthquake, of course, was before our time. Hurricane Katrina. But Halifax, Nova Scotia, the explosion of a munition ship in Halifax, that's in 1917. I don't think too many people even know that this happened.
You know, it was in Canada, which Margaret Atwood once said has the world's longest one-way mirror running along the border. But it's very well known in Canadian history. It was the biggest man-made explosion before nuclear weapons.
One-fifth the explosive power of Hiroshima.
Yeah, and this munition ship loaded for the front in France was in the harbor, probably shouldn't have been in the first place, and safety protocols were changed after this. Another ship, making some very bad decisions, collided with it, and the whole ship ignited, and it threw the anchor chain, cannons, pieces of the ship, incredible distances, created this huge fireball, a sort of air concussion, surge of water, and it was just an unimaginably hideous explosion that killed, more than 1,000 people, blinded hundreds of people, injured thousands, destroyed a significant portion of the town. And this was December 6, 1917.
It blinded people because there were eye injuries from glass and things like that?
Yeah, people were looking out the window, and suddenly the windows were blown out and shards of glass flew at people. And, you know, again, it was a disaster that unfolded with people behaving very well, with rescuing each other, putting things back together, and not just behaving well, with really extraordinary stories of mutual aid, of sacrifice. There, one man went back to telegram to tell the railroads not to, you know, to stop the trains so they wouldn't be blown up or derailed, even though that meant that he himself would die in the explosion. A young man went back to telephone to again stop people from approaching the impending explosion, and also died. And those people are heroes in Canada, although we haven't heard of them. People did really extraordinary things.
Well, a listener wonders if there's any effective way to motivate people toward this kind of generosity without a disaster.
You know, that was actually the most interesting question for me. Disasters happen in an era of climate change that we're already in. There will be more and more intense disasters, and it's important to know what happens to us in these extreme situations. But the real question is, how can we be these more altruistic, more deeply connected, more purposeful creatures in everyday life? And for me, disasters are really like being shaken awake. You stay awake and then you fall back asleep. And you really have to look at various disciplines and commitments that are, dedicated to remaining awake, that awakening that is being aware of other people's suffering, being aware of who you really want to be, being aware of what really matters. You know, there's a lot of religious examples that are very committed to something that looks very much like disaster relief in their effects and very much like the disaster state of mind, state of soul in their practices.
If this is so apparent to you, why isn't it to other people? For example, you mentioned a number of writers and pundits who argued, especially after Hurricane Katrina, that disasters of that sort reveal people's worst impulses. Timothy Garton Ash, the British intellectual who's been on the show a number of times, wrote that the big lesson is that the crust of civilization on which we tread is always wafer thin.
You know, that's one of those cliches, the thin crust of civilization, the thin veneer beneath which lies the kind of, you know, ravening beast. And he actually talked about that. One tremor and you've fallen through, scratching and gouging for your life like a wild dog. You know, those are the cliches that we get from the horror movies or the disaster movies. We get from a lot of government officials, etc. We've been told that we are Hobbesian creatures, that in the absence of authorities controlling us, of structures that govern our behavior, we revert to some kind of primordial savagery. And that turned out to be totally untrue in Katrina, although the media hysteria created a lot of chaos itself.
Well, you say, in effect, that the public isn't the problem. Often it's the official response to a disaster, often the direct government policy that is the source of so many of the problems.
A lot of the vigilantes, a lot of the government officials, et cetera, believe what Timothy Garton Ash believes, that we're essentially barbarian savages, et cetera, that institutions control. In fact, the institutions, I think, often bring out the worst of us and the worst in those authority figures, and people revert to something much more altruistic, anarchic in the best sense, in that they improvise, collaborate, connect in very deep ways.
Well, we had the government not really taking care of things. Katrina, for example, not fixing the levees, even though there had been warnings. The Army Corps of Engineers designed them poorly. FEMA, sure, was unprepared to do anything and didn't act particularly well after the fact?
Katrina, you can imagine, I don't know if Katrina had happened when Obama was president or something, what it would have looked like. But, you know, all those people could have been evacuated in the first day or two. FEMA prevented a lot of would-be rescuers and rescues, workers, supplies, etc., from coming into the city because they decided the city was too dangerous. They themselves were hysterical. The sheriff of Gretna and a bunch of armed henchmen pointed guns at anybody who wanted to just walk away from the Superdome and the convention center into the dry land from which they could be evacuated to the rest of the country. And those people were demonized, and that city essentially became a prison city with a completely social crisis that had nothing to do with the initial catastrophe of the hurricane and the levees breaking.
Well, often a part of the problem is fear about expense,
exactly.
But also class and race
play
parts in all of this. How do we get past that? Can we improve the government response to disasters like hurricanes and earthquakes?
You know, I think it's better in some places than other. And, you know, I am a big fan of my own city, I'm afraid, San Francisco. But in 89, there wasn't really much like that. There was some pretty sweet collaboration between people in the neighborhoods, for example, where the Nimitz Freeway collapsed in inner city Oakland, and the rescue workers. In fact, the first rescue efforts were made by people in that neighborhood before the emergency workers could get in. But the city of San Francisco also realized after the 89 earthquake, which was not a big one and whose epicenter was not San Francisco, that they did not have the resources to respond to a major disaster, that they had to rely on the citizens. And so they created a program. Many cities have one. Ours is maybe a little bit more visible and high profile and aggressive, but really to train and delegate citizens to respond. But the essential premise was that we should trust the citizens, that people are essentially good, that they will respond appropriately in a catastrophe, and that our focus does not need to be controlling them. It needs to be empowering them. More and more cities are learning from the disaster sociologists, from these examples and histories, and making better plans. But it's still something that matters immensely, because a disaster can often be magnified by this kind of elite panic, this kind of hostility and fear, these kinds of disaster myths. And overcoming them, is one of the first things you can do to really be prepared for a disaster.
Did we see the same sort of responses in other kinds of other disasters? The London Blitz, for example, Nicaragua's 1972 earthquake, Argentina's economic meltdown in 2001?
You know, there are enormous differences between being bombed by the Luftwaffe and having your economy trashed by your own government, as Argentina did. But there are some real similarities in the way that people really found enormous and joy is the word, and I always feel like, should I be saying joy about disasters? But joy is what people describe over and over in finding the sense of social connection that had been missing in their lives and feeling free to improvise, to connect, to make a society themselves, to act as members of civil society, to feel powerful and connected in ways that we ordinarily don't. And in all those disasters, they did. The Managua earthquake of 1972, in fact, is really considered to be the beginning of the end for the dictatorship that had ruled for several decades, and the real beginning of what would become the Sandinista Revolution 7 years later. It was a moment where people took power themselves, the government did nothing for them, and they just didn't feel like they wanted to hand it back to a government that had would been so callous and so corrupt.
Rebecca Solnit is the author of 10 books, including River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge, and The Technological Wild West, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Mark Linton History Prize. Her latest book is A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. It's published by Viking. And she will be speaking with Peter Coyote and taking audience questions tonight at 7 o'clock at the New York Public Library. That's at 11 West 40th Street in Manhattan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.